Good morning. It's 10:48 in the morning on January 26th, 2012. What I'm thinking about today was last night. The music departments here in Greeley's school district are amazing. First, they have an all-city band, an honor band, where the top players from all the different schools get an opportunity to come together once a year and put on a concert. That concert was last night. The high school honor band was the second act. The first act was the eighth grade masked band. Now, in order to get into this band, you only have to be in band in some school in the eighth grade. It was a huge, huge band. I don't have any idea how many, although I do have the program and I could, given a few minutes, probably count them up, but it was big. And the program was really quite good. They did four numbers. They did a very good job. It was hard to believe that the people on the stage playing this music were 13 years old. It was well directed, wonderfully executed, a lovely program for the eighth graders. And then they swapped over to the high school honor band, a much smaller group, fewer than 100, of some of the best players in the city at the high school level. And it doesn't matter what level of high school, as long as you're a good player, you can get into the honor band. My daughter plays French horn, and as such, is first chair at Greeley Central, so she gets to be in the honor band. The program for them was four numbers again. They brought in a guest conductor from the university down in Denver, Metro State. A funny guy, very well-respected band director, as opposed to an orchestra director, but he's definitely a band guy. And for the month of January, they've had two or three individual rehearsals where they'd all go over and meet in the evening for an hour and a half or 2 hours at the high school. And everybody get together and they would practice the music. They had the music pretty well under control. So that yesterday, I took her over and dropped her off, and she had a full-day clinic with this director and the whole band ensemble. Now, they played some really cool music. Some of it was quite difficult. They ended the program with a very avant-garde piece called The Foundry by a composer named John Mackey. If you Google it, you'll find a very good representation of it on YouTube and also on John Mackey's website. You can actually download a copy of it to listen to, stream a copy of it to listen to. I don't think you can actually download it. But to wrap up the program, and it was a short program. It was only an hour long with both bands, which is good. It was not enough for the audience to get restless, not enough to need an intermission, and yet long enough to give them a chance to display a certain level of virtuosity. The director did a really marvelous job of controlling this band with dynamics across various of the sections. This is something that the younger students don't seem to be able to get a good handle on, is that at this point, the trumpets play softly, the clarinets play loudly. In that part, the flutes play loudly, everybody else plays softly. They didn't really This is one of the things that's difficult for younger students to really gauge, is how loud are they in a mass of instruments? And for the high school people, that was not a problem. And the director, I want to say David Kish, K-I-S-H. He had them just eaten out of his hand. They did some amazing work. But the foundry was the closing number. And the foundry was astonishing. It's an atonal piece in many ways. It has a very syncopated rhythm to it. It's very reminiscent of, or evocative of a foundry, of a steel foundry, of the hammering and the clanking, of the banging, and the music of the hammers and the sound of the steel. I used to work in a foundry. I used to work in a steel forge. And there's part of working in a forge where the sound, the hammers, particularly a modern forge where you've got four or five guys running a hammer that strikes with a force of 5 tons or 8 tons or 12 tons. When you walk by, the ground shakes. You're sitting in the office outside, your coffee jitters. And the sound from this band for this performance brought all of that back. And I went home and found it online and listened to it about 7 times. The band actually, I think, did a much better job in the live performance than the recordings that I've managed to find for it. The recordings are good. In fact, I found one that I believe is the original official recording from University of Texas with the college band. And it's really quite good. But the kids did a better job. Part of the deal with this piece of music is found percussion. So they had to go out and scrounge up metal salad bowls, stuff that could clang, things that would make a bang sound. And they had some vibraslaps and some other more recognizable kinds of percussion instruments. What threaded it all together was the kid on the woodblocks. Now, way in the back of the band, tucked down behind everything, is this kid on a set of, and I don't know if it was 4 or 5 woodblocks, but they each had a different tone. And that kid was a clock ticking through this presentation of a completely syncopated, almost atonal presentation of the foundry. And those woodblocks and his keeping of the tempo and his changing of the rhythm and his ability to stitch the various pieces of that presentation together with his ticky-tocky sound from the tuned woodblocks in the back really, really made a huge, huge difference. We got to the end and it was like breathless because it was such a good song. They had done such a good job with it. They really added something to it that was their own, and it was astonishing. It was just amazing. And now I want to write a steampunk story. The steampunk novel, that is the theme song. But I don't know if I can get the rights to actually use it. Something to think about anyway. Because that is steampunk music. It was wonderful. So let's see, what else am I thinking about? Not a whole lot. That was that was pretty much it. Trying to get ready to go south tomorrow. I'm heading down to Colorado Springs, probably about this time tomorrow morning. So I've got to get the walk in early, get that out of the way. I also need to do one more podcast for my students. Oh, speaking of which, there was something else I was thinking about. Through my feed reader yesterday, I came across something that has hit me two or three different times over the last week from different directions. I finally took a moment and went and watched a presentation by a professor from Stanford, an ex-Stanford professor named Sebastian Thrun, T-H-R-U-N, a German, used to work for Stanford as an AI professor, and he ran into Salman Khan, the guy who started the Khan Institute, and noted that here's this guy who basically in his spare time recorded a bunch of very short videos for math, and he makes those available pretty much for free online, and his stuff has been viewed in total well over a million times. And Trun goes back to his class, which is a very popular class in Stanford, which has, instead of the normal 20, it has 200, which he thought was a really good number until he started comparing that to a million. And he realized, we haven't scratched the surface. This is impossible. This is a dropper full compared to the need. And so Stanford is involved in an open education initiative at the moment. And so he got his heads together, his department head and a few others, and they said, well, let's make it free and available for everyone on the internet. And what we'll do is we'll give them grades, we'll give them a certificate at the end that certifies that they completed it, and we'll see what happens. And he thought, you know, well, maybe 1,000 people. Be pretty cool, up from 200. By the next morning, he says he had 1,000 people. By the next night, he had 5,000. By the time the class started, there was 160,000 people in his class. At which point, he said, holy crap! Or something akin to it. How do you teach 160,000 people? And they set about figuring out how to do it. And for the most part, it was quite literally a camera, a pen, and a napkin, and some technology that turned their videos into quizzes so that they were giving everybody a quiz with every lesson that they could then capture and grade, which was pretty astonishing, pretty heady stuff. Until he realized that he was really doing the same old thing that everybody always did in an online class. He's just doing it on a massive scale. And that the reality was that he needed to change the way he was thinking about the class, because the class was really, in its fundamental form, the lecture is a way for the instructor to look smart while making the students feel dumb. And this is very true. And he really didn't like that view of higher education, education in general. And so he set about to try to change it. This video, I linked to it on Phaedrus. If you just Google Sebastian Thrun, T-H-R-U-N, I'm sure you'll find it. You can go look on my teaching blog on Phaedrus. There's a link to it there. That was the last thing that I linked to, I think. An astonishing vision of higher education as it needs to happen. I gave it to my class, and already somebody said, well, you know, that's good, but what does this mean for teachers? And I think the fundamental point that Trun makes, he gets asked this question at the end by one of the hosts, and he says, you know, there really will always be a place for the Stanfords. There will always be a place for the school. There will always be a place for people who want that ability to go to a place and to sit in a class with their peers in real time and do that activity. But his vision was not how to reach those people, because those people have to reach him. His vision was, how do you reach people who can't? How do you reach the single mothers? How do you reach, he had some really heartwarming letters from a soldier in Afghanistan, and a single mother with two kids, and how do you make education, how do you make the benefits of learning available to people who can't uproot their lives, move to California, to pay the $40,000 a year to go to Stanford, but still deserve a quality education, still want a quality education, whether they deserve it or not, it's really moot. It's something that they want. It's something that would improve, in general, the human condition as a whole. It goes back to a conversation that David Wiley once had with a group of undergrads, graduate students, wherein he postulated that the appropriate use of research money was not in researching how to teach kids to read better, that is, how to teach better children to read, because we already know pretty well how to teach a kid to read. He argued that a more appropriate use of the research funding would be to find ways to reach more people with what we already know, to reach more people who needed to learn to read, to reach more people who needed to learn, period. Because if we improve our ability to teach by 10%, we're not reaching any more people. We're just teaching the people we do reach quicker, which isn't necessarily a valid goal. I mean, it might be efficiency, but is learning to read fast really an objective, a valid one? Wouldn't it make more sense to be able to reach 10% more people with what we do know? So 10% more people could read. So in the United States, where something on the order of 65% of the population, only 65% of the population reads at an 8th grade or higher level, we could improve that by 7%. We could take it up to 72% of the people could read at an 8th grade level. What will that do to our culture? What will that do to our social structures? What would it mean if millions of people can program their own computers? Right now, millions of people can't program their own VCRs. What if they could program computers? What if they could program their own computers? What if they could understand the meaning of social media? Not just how to use Twitter, log on, type your name, 140 characters, go, but what does social media mean to the culture? I'm going to teach on Monday at the high school. I've got three creative writing classes that I'm going to visit with, and some of the creative writing instructor, one of the creative writing instructors, Ryan Humphrey. I just followed him on Twitter. I'm going to try to remember to give him a follow Friday tomorrow, because we really need to get Brian and his buddy David, who are doing this new roundtable podcast, into the fold and up to speed. Right at the moment, they're struggling to understand what this is all about, because it's very foreign to them. It's very different from what they expected. One of the fundamental issues with releases, how do you get signed releases from your guests? And he asked that on a podcasting forum, and the podcasters went, what? Why would we get a release? It's like, well, to protect everyone. It's like, you know, everybody's basic assumption is that if you're on the podcast, you understand that it's being recorded and sent out. Otherwise, you wouldn't be on the podcast. There's a certain level of expertise inherent in the participation that neither David nor Brian really anticipated. They didn't really consider that as being part of the experience. Sort of like the notice on ahead of customer service calls when you call in and they say, this call may be recorded for quality assurance. You know, you're calling into a podcast, you're lending your voice to a podcasting activity which will then be turned around and sent out, which you know fully well going in is going to be broadcast out onto the world, and we'll take your voice and whatever you happen to say and move it out. In a certain sense, you're trusting that the editing process that happens after you stop talking and before it actually gets distributed won't make you sound like too much of a ninny. And the reality is that the podcasters really need you to trust them to do that so they don't mess it up.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, you know, there's this whole other world of rights management and protection of IP that, as podcasters, we don't think anything about. It's not that we don't address it. It's that it's assumed and considered part of the process, part of the generally accepted procedure. Anyway, I made it all the way around. I had a lot to talk about today, I think. And what was amazing is that I didn't know what I was going to talk about when I started. But I'm at the back gate. Tomorrow's another day. I'll talk to you then.